This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Baseball Hall of Famer Bob Gibson is one of the greatest pitchers in history. He won the National League's Most Valuable Player Award in 1968, the year he won 22 games, led the league with 268 strikeouts, and had an earned run average of 1.12, a major league record. He shut out every team except the Dodgers. During his career with the St. Louis Cardinals, he had a reputation for not talking much with the press and for revealing as little as possible about himself. But he reflects on his life and career in his new autobiography, Stranger to the Game. He told me he didn't like to take orders from his catcher.
I felt if you throw a pitch that you don't want to pitch, you're not going to have your heart in it and it's not going to be good. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you when that happened. I remember back when I was very, very young, and you do have to pay attention to what other people think about the league and the hitters when you don't know them yourself. Carl Sawatzky was a catcher for the Cardinals, and he and I had a disagreement about what pitch to throw to a hitter. And I was young, and he was experienced, and I would shake him off. And he finally called timeout, and he came out to the mound to tell me that he wanted me to throw a certain pitch. Well, when he went back, got down, and I threw that pitch, the guy hit a home run. And from that point on, I said, I'll never do it again. Now, that's not to say that you don't take orders or you don't follow what the catcher wants you to do. But if you don't want to do it, then I say don't do it.
Now, Tim McCarver was your catcher for many years. How did he feel about that?
Well, he felt the same way. You never throw a pitch that you don't want to throw. And usually a catcher like McCarver had his head in the game so much, and he was so smart about what he was doing back there that I didn't shake him off that often anyway. When I did shake, it was usually to confuse the hitter.
You used to use the brushback pitch. Tell me about your strategy for when the brushback would be the appropriate way to pitch to someone.
Well, when I played, that's the way the game was played. And the brushback pitch really isn't what it sounds like. What you do, you throw the ball in off the plate. The idea of getting a hitter out, you don't get him out inside. You get him out away. And so what the hitter tries to do in order to keep that ball away from being away, they'll lean over the plate, and then the ball away is more or less either from the middle of the plate in. So you don't want him to lean over. You pitch inside off of the plate. Now you make him think about that ball coming in here. And if he's not thinking about it coming in there, probably it will hit him. So what the hitter likes to do is to either look for the ball inside or look for it away. To keep him from looking for it away, you throw him inside, get him off the plate, which people call a brushback pitch, and then you throw him away.
I guess, you know, your aim has to be awfully good if you're pitching inside when the batter's crowding the plate, otherwise you'll hit the batter.
Right. I didn't hit batters that often. And they knew that I would pitch inside. And this is one of the weapons that you have. If you throw inside often enough, they know that you're going to come in here. So they're aware of the ball being inside, and that's why you're so effective away. Very seldom will you hit a guy inside. If you want to hit him, you don't throw it inside anyway. You throw it behind him.
Why?
Well, because the first instinct is to move back. And so if you throw a ball behind a guy and he moves back, usually it'll hit him.
Now, were there times when you intentionally tried to hit a batter?
Oh, sure. And usually that was retaliation. We had a couple of guys, Lou Brock, Curt Flood, and Julian Javier. They got hit constantly. They were very fast. They get on the bases and they just drove you guys nuts. So they did get hit. And whenever one of my guys got hit when I was pitching, I would just return the favor.
Now, you hit Duke Snider once and broke his elbow?
Oh, he hit himself.
He hit himself?
Yeah.
Why don't you explain that?
Well, Duke Snider was a pull hitter, dead pull hitter. And he liked the ball inside. He's a left-hand hitter. And when they first moved out to the Coliseum, and the Coliseum's right field fence was a long way away, but the left field fence was only 250 feet away. And Duke Snider did not hit the ball to left field. First time I faced him, he hit a home run over that little fence out there, which was fine. You know, okay, I'm going to have to start pitching him a little differently. I pitched him away a little farther, about 3 or 4 inches outside, and he reached out and hit the ball. It would have been a home run, but it went foul. And that was the second time up. Well, the next pitch I threw him was inside. Here we go with this pitch that I'm telling you. It keeps the guy from leaning out. Well, he went back out there thinking that the ball was going to be outside, and it hit him in the elbow, broke his elbow.
How did you feel when that happened?
Oh, it was his fault. It wasn't mine. And in fact, I went over to talk to him after the game, and he told me, he says, yeah, he says, I was leaning out there, and I shouldn't have been doing it.
Hmm. Did you ever get hit while you were at bat?
Sure. I got hit a lot.
Was that retribution against your pitching?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it was the way the game was played.
Boy, so every time you intentionally hit a batter, did you figure, well, that means I'm going to get hit when I'm at
well,
bat?
We're making it sound like...
Like it happened a lot of times, which it didn't.
Yeah, and it didn't happen that often. See, you got a guy back there called umpire, and he usually stops all of this.
Right.
When somebody gets hit on my team, and I go back out there and I hit somebody on that team, the umpire will call timeout. He says, okay, guys, that's enough. And usually that is enough, and it stops.
Right.
So you don't spend all game throwing at each other.
Mm-hmm, right. Just tell me more about what your strategy was like when you were on the mound.
All right. We would go into a town, for instance, going into Philadelphia, and we have a three-game series. The first game of each series, we have a report from the scouts, and we would go over each individual hitter. We knew exactly how to pitch them, how to play defense against them. And so what you would do, you would go over it and refresh your memory on what to do. So that's not to say that you would pitch like that all the time. But if you got into a situation where this guy could beat you with a base hit or a home run or what have you, then you went to your strategy. You went to those scouting reports. And pretty much if you stayed there, you'd get the guy out. But if you were continually pitching a guy according to that, he was going to most of those hitters are good enough to adjust to that, so you try not to pitch them like that all the time.
Baseball Hall of Famer Bob Gibson is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Baseball Hall of Famer Bob Gibson is my guest. He has a new autobiography. It was, I think, in the summer of 1967, you were hit above your ankle by a line drive, and you stayed in the game and kept pitching in spite of the fact that you were hit. How did you manage to play, given you had a broken bone?
Well, I wasn't aware that the bone was broken to begin with. I got hit with a line drive off of the bat of Roberto Clemente, and the trainer came out and sprayed my ankle with ethyl chloride, you know, and that freezes everything. It took the pain away. In fact, I didn't know my foot was still there. And so I continued to pitch, because I had no feeling in it. And then I finally tried to throw one pitch a little too hard, and I popped the bone, the small bone, and had them. That made me quit. I fell down, and we went right directly to the hospital and didn't pass go.
Did you hear the sound?
Oh, yeah, I heard it.
That's an awful sound, huh?
It was an awful sound, and the pain was excruciating. And I didn't realize that the bone had broken. When I heard that sound, I looked around to see what it was. For an instant, it sounded like somebody was behind me and popped their hands together. And then I went down and I knew what it was.
Looking back, are you sorry that you kept playing?
Oh, if I had it to do over again, sure. In fact, if that were to happen today, they'd take a little bit better care of the players than they did back in those days.
They wouldn't have let you keep going.
They wouldn't have let me.
You know, Tim McCarver tells this story of the time you broke a strikeout record during the World Series, and he was trying to call your attention to the fact that it was on the scoreboard. On the scoreboard, it said Gibson's 15th strikeout in one game ties the all-time World Series record held by Sandy Koufax. And he kept pointing, and you kept yelling, "Throw the ball," because you had no idea what he was trying to get your attention for.
So, absolutely no idea.
So how did you feel when you actually turned around and realized that A, that you'd broken the record, and B, that it was on the scoreboard?
Well, those kind of things really aren't things that I'm concerned about, especially in the heat of the battle.
Really, you're not thrilled by breaking a record?
Not right then, no. It means a lot more to you 20 years from then, when you're sitting back and sipping on a glass of wine and thinking about what you accomplished. But during the time, no, it's not really that big a deal. Not just with me. I don't think with too many people.
Hmm.
not for professionals, when you're an amateur and you do something for the first time, I think there's a little bit different feeling.
I think you were the first black athlete to get a scholarship to the college that you went to. And you got
Creighton University.
Did you get a scholarship in basketball and baseball?
No. It was a basketball scholarship, and I just happened to play baseball during the summer, yeah.
So did you think that you would go into basketball at that time?
I thought I was going to be a basketball player, more so than a baseball player. But when I got to be a senior, I thought that maybe, and it didn't seem like anybody was interested that much in me from the professional ranks, I thought maybe I would probably end up in baseball.
You actually played with the Globetrotters for a while, and was it around 57?
Yeah, 1957.
And you roomed with Meadowlark Lemon.
Yes, I did.
But you say you hated the clowning, which is what the Globetrotters were most famous for.
Yes, but I didn't know that at the time because the Globetrotters came into Omaha, and in 1957, and I guess a year or two before that, they had a series with the College All-Stars where they played real basketball. And so I played with the College All-Stars, and I didn't really get to play until the last quarter. I scored a lot of points, and we ended up beating the Globetrotters. Well, they asked me to go with them after that. And so that following fall, I went into Chicago, worked out, made the team. And when we started playing, we started doing the clowning thing. And I didn't realize at first that's what it was. So I didn't really care for that, no.
What? Why not?
I'm not a clown.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard to learn the stunts that the Globetrotters did?
No, it's not hard at all. If you, it's really funny. When you're young, you spin the ball on your finger and you do some of those things. I don't know why you do it, but when it came time to play, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to play basketball.
You said before that breaking records didn't really mean much to you at the time. What did it mean to you to get voted into the Hall of Fame in 1980?
81.
81, okay.
Yeah, going into the Hall of Fame is something that nobody really thinks about while they're playing. And after you finish your career, whatever it is, and you sit down and you think about it, the best thing that could possibly ever happen to you after you get through playing is to go into the Hall of Fame. And when I was inducted, first of all, I thought I would never be inducted because I didn't, you know, the guys that vote on you were reporters. And I didn't talk with reporters a lot, especially on the day that I pitched. I tried to stay away because they would distract you. So I never thought I was going to go into the Hall of Fame. And in fact, I was prepared not to be selected. They called me and told me that they were going to have the voting and, you know, there was a good chance that I would go in there. So I pretty much resigned myself to the fact that I wasn't going to go in because I didn't think the reporters liked me. But after I went in, after they had the election and I went in, it was, I don't think there's any other feeling greater than that, knowing that they thought, and by they I mean the press and the people that watched you play, thought you were one of the best players ever. It was a great feeling.
What have you been doing since your retirement?
I make a lot of speeches here and there and do a lot of interviews, public appearances. I've done some broadcasting. I ran a restaurant, started a bank. You name it, I did it. I tried some of everything.
And what have you enjoyed the most?
Broadcasting the games. I really do enjoy that. I did that for about 10 years. And I got away from it for 1 year. I was trying something new. And one thing I did find out, when you try to get back, it's very difficult because in broadcasting, most sports, they like to get the fresh new names out there. And so it's really difficult to get back in there right now, but I'm still hoping.
Does your arm ever give you trouble now?
Let me tell you, when you play sports, you have aches and pains the rest of your life. And it's all a part of what you do. You take some aspirins and you have a glass of wine and you forget it.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay.
Bob Gibson, his new autobiography is called Stranger to the Game. This is Fresh Air.